So if you, so I think I lost people towards the end of the last lecture, some people. So I'll try and make it clear how this is working. So this is a summary of the last lecture. So we have this situation. We have two regions of operational space, A and B. Then we have solutions, psi tilde A, psi tilde B, which are defined on manifolds, or parts of manifolds. I'm just calling these things manifolds, even though they're not full manifolds. They're subsets of manifolds. On manifolds MA and MB. And so this solution here defined on this manifold gets mapped into gamma A. And likewise, this here gets mapped into gamma B. Okay. We want to know if these two things join together in such a way that if this is a solution and this is a solution, then the composite thing is also a solution. Okay. When I say a solution, I mean an actual solution to the field equations. So to do that, we want to check boundary conditions, which sort of live here at this surface where the two regions meet. Okay. This surface here, I give it a bit of structure. So there's the set of points. So that's just in this diagram, it's the rectangle. The set of points in that rectangle. Then I also embed a coordinate system in here. So we have, so these are a set of scalars. They're functions of the scalars that define operational space. And you choose them so that one of them is pointing out. So one of them increases as you go out of the typing surface, and the other ones are embedded in the typing surface. If you replace xa0 with minus xa0, they need to know that just by a sub ar. Okay, so that's just where you change the direction. Okay. The thing we're aiming towards, the thing I started off with, is this double cup union of psi a and psi b. These are diffeomorphism invariant objects. And then the way we define that is that we take the this special union of these solutions for each psi a tilde and psi b tilde in their respective sets. Okay, I think, is that all clear? But we've got this funny symbol here. This is the union, but there's a subscript, so it's got some extra structure, and that's basically to check that there is matching. If there isn't matching, then we throw away the entry. If there is matching, then we keep it. So we want to understand if there's matching or not. And matching basically consists of two different things. We have what I called the architecture. So this is to be sure that the manifolds themselves match at the boundary. And then we have what I call wallpaper. And this is to check that the fields defined on those manifolds and some derivatives of those fields match. Okay. So the way that works, so first of all, the architecture, that's what I was talking about last week. So the architecture is where you have a, you take the points on this manifold that live at the boundary, okay? So this is the set of all points on this manifold that live at the boundary that corresponds to this typing surface. Okay, is that clear? So you define it as the set of points such that the value of S at that point is in the set, a associated with this typing surface. Is that clear? Okay. Right. So that's the set of points coming from here. Of course, in order to define this, you need to look at the solution psi tilde A, because that's where you calculate S from. To calculate S, you need to look at the fields, and they live in here. So this set is defined with respect to a particular solution. And you can do the same thing on the B side, and you get another set. Now, there's a problem, which is that this set of points in the manifold are a subset of the chartable space A. Then over here, you have a different chartable space. But that's OK, because we have these identity maps that you can use to map between different chartable spaces, just basically looking for numerical equivalence. So one way we could do this is we could check that if we map this one into this one, we get the same set of points, or vice versa. But a more symmetric way to do it is to associate yet another chartable space with the boundary, so with the typing surface, and then map both of those into that third set. Okay. And that's nice, because also it means we can talk about boundary conditions as objects in themselves without referring to either of the two places they've come from. Okay, so that's what we do. So when we map, I mean, this notation is slightly funny, but when we map this set of points into a new chartable space associated with the typing surface under the fiducial identity map, then we get this on the A side, and we get this on the B side. Okay, and we want to be sure that those two sets of points are equal. Okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it's not enough just that they match. We want this new object to form a manifold as well, or part of a manifold. So they have to also match in direction. So we don't want them to sort of double back on themselves. So we can do that by imposing direction matching, which looks at the derivatives of these fields. I talked about that last week. The details aren't so important. And then also, we want to be sure that we have smoothness. So when you define a manifold, there's this third property you define, which is where the transition maps are smooth. And so we need to define smoothness matching here. And the details of how this works aren't so important. Okay. Any questions there? Is there? Yeah. Okay, so that's the architecture. And if these conditions are satisfied, then you know that these two manifolds join together to form a new manifold. And then there's the wallpaper conditions. So you now want it to be the case that the fields themselves match at this boundary. And then also that some number of the derivatives match. And this is important because you want to be sure that the union of these two things is itself also a solution to the Einstein field equations. And since the Einstein field equations are local on the manifold, it's going to be sufficient to just look at the fields and some number of derivatives. Okay. Right. And one more thing. If this matching condition is satisfied, then we say that the new manifold we get is written this way, and we identify the points that are the boundary. So we identify points in here with the points in here. under the fiducial identity map. And that identifying point is a typical move in differential geometry. Look at the any questions before I move on? Okay. So now I want to actually write down explicitly what the boundary conditions look like. So first of all, let's define this object. So this is meant to be a capital theta, backslash theta. I'm going to define that as being the direction conditions. These are conditions that have to be true at each point where you check them. The smoothness. Conditions. And then also the fields and the derivatives of the fields. So these are all the things you need to check. And you need to check them at each point. At each point here, where the manifolds meet up. Okay. So we define. This is an object to help us do that. So lowercase theta. These are going to be the boundary conditions at typing surface A induced by psi tilde A. So we have to check them. These things match at each point in the manifolds that meet at the boundaries. So we have to check for each point P that these fields match. We have to do that for all points in this part of the manifold. So what I'm saying isn't difficult, but it may take a bit of digesting. Is that clear? So the full set of things we need to check match up are that every point in the manifold, all these fields match. Okay. And this thing is defined on psi tilde, so it's not a diffeomorphism invariant object. But we can get ourselves a diffeomorphism invariant object just by doing it in the obvious heavy-handed fashion.
Lucien?
Yeah.
Shouldn't it depend on psi tilde B as well?
So these are the boundary conditions coming from the A side.
Oh, so you mean like?
And we're going to want these to match with the boundary conditions coming from.
This theta is not.
This is, yeah. And we're going to want this to match with the boundary condition coming from the B side. Yeah. So we can define invariant, diffeomorphism invariant objects just by a sort of obvious thing. So this is a function of psi A, not psi tilde A, but psi A. And we remove the tilde from the theta as well. And that's just defined to be the set of all these. Is that clear? It took me a long time to get to this object, but this is the sort of diffeomorphism of invariant boundary conditions that need to be checked to see if you've got matching or not. Okay, so now we've got this. We can now write down what I mean by this union of solutions. So this object is equal to either this. So it could be equal to this. This is the sort of essentially the union of the two solutions I have at the very top here, except that you've also identified the points where the two manifolds meet. If you have the boundary conditions matching, and otherwise it's equal to the blank element and this blank element is just the element that if you add it to a set it doesn't change the set, so take some set and you add the blank element to it and you just get the same set. So what's happening is when you take this double cup join of two states at the very top there, you're going through all the psi tilde A's and all the psi tilde B's and seeing which ones match under these matching conditions. And the ones that do match, you keep, and the other ones you throw away. So of course, generically, the matching is going to only happen is going to be seldom, because for any case where you have matching, there's an infinite number of cases that don't match. On the other hand, if two solutions do match, then any diffeomorphism that acts on this one in the same way as this one at the boundary will also produce a matching pair. So if you have one match, then you'll have many matches. And you can say the double cup union of two solutions is not equal to the null solution. So remember, this is the solution that is just the empty set. There's no solutions in it. If and only if there's some overlap between the boundary conditions. as I could have said that in a simpler fashion. I could have said that this is equal to the null set if these things don't overlap. And the reason for that is if these things have a non-trivial intersection, that means there are some pairs of solutions, psi tilde A and psi tilde B, that actually match in their boundary conditions. Is that clear? So for this to be a useful way of joining solutions, it has to be the case that if psi A is a solution, psi B is a solution, then the double cup union is also a solution. So if psi A is an actual solution to the field equations, and likewise this one, then the double cup union also has to be an actual solution. So I decided to just state that as an assumption. Let me write that assumption down. The local matching assumption. And I'm going to write it down for pure solutions. So remember, if I drop the specification, this set of solutions is just the actual pure solution. Maybe I could write it in. So for solutions like this, this should be in the set of solutions for the composite region that are actual and mixed. For some choice of pi. Remember, pi is a list of derivatives of the fields. For some list of derivatives of the field which has a finite number of elements. So the reasoning here is that it wouldn't be very impressive if you had to check all derivatives of the fields to be sure you had matching. That's just basically, of course, if all the derivatives of the fields match, then matching is guaranteed. But you have field equations operating in the background. So if some set of derivatives match and those field equations are also satisfied, then you can be sure in the right circumstances that all the derivatives match. At least that's the assumption. Yeah. So the assumption is there's a finite list of derivatives which you can put into theta at the top there, so that this is true. The other thing to note is that I'm demanding that the union, or the join of these two things, I'm demanding that the join of these two things is an actual mixed solution, not an actual pure solution. You might have thought that if this was pure and this was pure, then the join should be pure. On the other hand, if you went to the colloquium, you'd know that that isn't the case. Indeed, it's not the case. There are examples that show that, which I'll discuss next. Any questions on this? Okay.
I'm trying to recall the definition of omega A, for instance. I get the idea that it's all the actual pure solutions, but I'm wondering, should psi A be a subset or an element in it? What exactly was that?
Sorry, again, psi...
Like, any of these actually, like omega A and psi A, for instance?
Yeah.
Is psi A an element in omega A, or is it a subset, and what exactly...
Yeah, it's an element, yeah. This is.
So omega A is...
Yeah. All right. It's just a set of these solutions
that all map the operational region A.
Yeah, and yeah, that's right. And so I, corresponding to region A, and you can do it for different specifications.
Yeah.
Be pure, mixed, actual, candidate. So yeah, this is the set of all pure solutions that live in region A.
So here, you're saying that for any regions A and B, or like there is a fixed like pi, we find a number of elements regardless of which regions you choose.
Yeah, yeah. This should be for all A, B, or all typing surfaces, etc. Yeah. So that's an assumption. I don't prove that this is true in the paper, other than if you have a set of local field equations, then it seems likely that it's true, but I don't give a natural proof. And in any case, it's difficult to prove these things because there's many different matter field equations you can have.
Yeah.
And so it's conceivable that it's not true for some.
And why would you not be happy with infinite time? Like, comfortable set?
It seems then it's not really even. Then it's just true. I suppose it may not be all different. You may have an uncountable set, but it's still not all the derivatives.
Yeah.
It's also fine. You could relax to an infinite set. It seems. Suddenly, if you look in papers where they talk about matching conditions, there's a finite set of matching conditions. It seems like the assumption has more meat if you say that, but you could consider it relaxing.
I just don't really see the need for it.
Well, how about put it this way? Suddenly, you would want to choose, if there is a finite set, that's the one you would want to choose, rather than some infinite set. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. So I'm going to talk about non-separability, or as I'm trying to brand it, curious non-separability. So the point is that it's possible that when you have pure solutions in each of the regions, you still have mixed for the double cup join. mixed. And there's an example in the paper on page 63. But let me just sketch how the example works. I think a few of you stayed behind afterwards last time, and I showed you this before. So I'm going to draw a picture in manifold space. So imagine in manifold space, you know, you have some regions. So you have two cylindrical regions. So start with a circle at some initial time, and we're going to evolve that into bigger. We have two concentric circles. We'll get. A cylinder with a shell around the outside of it.
Okay.
And I'm just going to imagine we have 2 + 1 dimensions of the manifold because I can draw it. So here is, let's call this region MA. So that's the outer shell. This is region A, region MA. And the inner shell is region MB. And imagine there exist lots of fluids. It could just be simple dust fluids. And they're all physically equivalent, except that they're different colors. So red, green, blue. And in the example I give, you have, on page 63, you have 3 different colored fluids. And then you can choose for your operational space the densities of each of these fluids. So red, green, blue. And we're going to make, so, and each of these fluids have the same properties. We'll make it so that the sum of the densities and the sum, if we just take the sum of all the fluids, just ignore the color, then we have a cylindrically spherical situation. So if it's initially initially has circular symmetry, and then each of these things will couple to the gravitational field in the same way, so it will evolve in a way that has circular symmetry. So we'll have cylindrical symmetry as we go up. And then furthermore, we ensure that in the vicinity of this boundary between the two surfaces, between the two regions of the manifold, within the vicinity of this boundary, we ensure that all the different colors, all the different fields are cylindrically symmetric. Okay, so they're, so there's no way to distinguish where you are on any given sort of constant time, height, circle on this cylinder by looking at the field. So you have complete cylindrical symmetry on the shell and in the vicinity of the shell. So that means that the fields and all the derivatives of the fields will be equal as you go around any circle. It's possible to choose the fields in such a way that this region of the manifold and this one map onto different regions of operational space. Okay. And then the final thing we do in the example is ensure that there are some asymmetries in here. So there's some sort of asymmetry in the fluid distributions in the center, and also an asymmetry away in the shell. Okay, so some sort of features that mark out a cylindrical asymmetry. So if you do all these things, and then you consider any given situation with certain positions for these asymmetries, well, because you have the cylindrical symmetry on the boundary, that means if you rotate the inner cylinder by any amount, you still have matching. But if you do that, you have a physically inequivalent situation because the distance between these asymmetric features is different in each of those cases. So that shows you can have a situation where the solutions in each region are pure, and yet, if you take the double Cup union, you're going to pick up lots of matching from physically inequivalent situations. And so you get this non-separability. So by non-separability, what I mean is you fully specify what's happening in region A. All the B-ables concerned with region A are given by psi A. Likewise, all the B-ables for region A are given by psi A. Likewise for region B. And yet, you're not able to specify what the B-ables are for the joint region. You don't get that out as a solution. As a unique solution, there's many different solutions that are consistent with those descriptions. Any questions on that?
I think there's something I just don't understand about. Maybe it's because I'm not used to the operational way of thinking, but this double cup seems to be some kind of epistemological thing where you have information and then you have other pieces of information and try to put them together. But psi A and psi B, that just, I would assume that you would be doing this with something like experimental outcomes, but psi A and psi B just don't seem like outcomes of any experiment.
Psi A and psi B are not outcomes, they're ontological descriptions. The experimental outcomes are the gammas. Now, it's possible that there's a one-to-one map between the gamma A and psi A, but it's also possible there isn't.
So you have a device that beeps every time you're in operational region A, and then you go walking around and you can't wait, beeps, and you can like draw a map. Is that like an experiment you have in mind?
So you can imagine that in region A, you know, specify some particular gamma A set. And if this is the gamma A set that you see, you can imagine your device bleeps.
Right.
So that's your outcome.
Okay, so if psi A and psi B are rather like ontological objects rather than epistemological objects, why are we taking these like inference type of unions where we try to say we have a piece of information, another piece of information, what can we infer from them together?
So the question is, it's a typical question to ask in physics. If this is my situation here and this is my situation here, what's my situation in the total region, in the composite region?
Yes.
And it seems to me that this double cup union is the best thing you can do in terms of getting a handle on that.
Is there like the building blocks, like talking about that? The ontological elements, which are these psi A and psi B.
Yeah.
Like when you are just specified like gamma A, and that can be like a range of psi A's, but once you specify how to compose psi A's, you know how to compose like sets of psi A's, right?
Right, yeah. So what you can do from this exactly is you can now take the psi A you get for a given gamma set A. So this now becomes. This is sort of ontological, and this is the underlying, this is operational, and then so gamma A is operational, and psi A is the underlying ontological entity associated with that. And likewise, you can have this, and then you can use this double cup union to join them together and see what you get for the composite region.
Just remind me what it means when they mix.
Say again, sorry?
Just remind me what it means when they mix.
So a pure solution is one where every element is diffeomorphism equivalent. So there's a diffeomorphism transformation between every element. And a mixed solution is one where that's not true. Is that clear?
Okay.
So if psi A and psi B are pure, then there's only really one thing going on. Whereas if
they're manifolds, self, I guess, that's what they're.
Sorry?
Well, no, they're not full manifolds, but they're different.
So if you're interested in possibilistic questions, so you've got some operational description, you say, well, in region A, I have gamma A, region B, I have gamma B. That's the situation I'm interested in. I want to know if gamma A union gamma B is possible or not. Is that possible? Well, then I can construct the double cup union of this. And if this is non-null, then I know that that's possible.
Yeah, okay.
So these are the kinds of questions you can start to ask.
Yeah.
When you've got this framework, these sort of possibilistic questions.
Okay.
Okay. So I think I'm ready to move on to the next. Oh no, there's okay. So I'm looking forward to getting to the next subject, which is agency. There's still a few things I need to talk about. Well, you know what? Did you have a question?
I did, but I can ask after if you're in a hurry.
No, it's okay. Ask the question.
Is there another operation you could define? Because it seems like, if I understand the situation correctly, like what basically is happening is that there's things in psi A and psi B separately that when you join them together aren't compatible with one another, so you end up with a mixed solution, I guess.
The other thing is there's multiple things that are compatible at the boundary. And so you end up with many different pure solutions, so you get a mixed solution.
I forget if you define this or not, but it seems like one could define another operation that like sort of filtered out the double cup to recover a pure solution.
So there's a thing I call the sort solution. So what that does is if you apply that to a mixed solution, it sorts into all the pure solutions which are consistent with that mixed solution.
Okay, yeah.
So one way to say what's happening here is that you could have this and this both pure. So the sort has a single element, and yet the sort of this could have more than one element.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
And the sort returns all the ontologically distinct situations compatible with a given mixed solution. Okay. So I think I need to talk about sets of pure solutions. So let's put that there. Okay, so sets. So So just like we had different types of sets of solutions, we can also think about different types of sets of boundary solutions. So so this is a set of boundary conditions that satisfies some given specification. And these can be the same specifications we had before, so pure, mixed, actual, candidate. So the elements of this set are boundary conditions like this, for all states, for all solutions that are in the corresponding set of solutions, same spec. And that's not quite enough, because here we have a subscript A. So also for all A, such that the set of points associated with the typing surface is in the boundary of A. So this is the set of all solutions of the given type. So this is a set of all the boundary conditions that can be induced by all solutions of the given type at a set A. Okay. And the case we're most interested in is the actual pure case. And so we write that as A. We just omit, in that case, we omit the specification, because this is the case that we're most interested in. Okay, so just one bit of notation. It's kind of cumbersome to keep writing theta sub A of psi A each time. So we're just going to write the elements of these sets of boundary conditions, like so. So this is a different font. So it's going to get a bit hairy when it comes to my scribblings on the blackboard. So the A one is fine. Let's try B. So, okay. C is really difficult. So the boundary conditions, and this could be for any specification. The boundary conditions that live in this set are just denoted by the same letter, but in a different font as the typing surfaces. And that's especially useful because later on we'll be writing these things as subscripts and superscripts. And so it's much less cumbersome than if we had, you know, the thetas and so on. Okay. Right. Okay, so it's too late to start the subject of agency. Maybe I'll just say a few things about that just to tell you for next week. So in quantum theory, we have these boxes and we wire them together. And the boxes have knobs on them that you can select, choose different settings, as well as outcomes. So far we have outcomes because those are the different gamma surfaces. We can also coarse grain the outcomes as well. But we don't have knob settings. Here's a box in the laboratory. Quantum systems go in and come out through various holes. We have one or more knobs on it that we can vary. And then we have lights that flash, detect or click or whatever. Those are the outcomes. So we want to say what the analog is of this knob setting. And the way people normally think about GR is that you specify some initial conditions at the beginning of the universe, or whatever period of time you're interested in, and then you evolve them forward. That's the way solutions are normally obtained in general relativity. But here we want to be considering the case where you enter information as the solution evolves, or as things progress, because you think about it in quantum theory, you specify this knob setting as the system evolves. Rather than specifying them all at the beginning of time. They're not part of the original state. You could do that. You could have it so that the boxes themselves are incorporated into the initial quantum state, and then the knob settings would also be part of the initial quantum state. But in operational formulations of quantum theory, you typically don't do that, and it's much less cumbersome if you don't have to. In the case of general relativity, here's a sort of motivating example. Imagine you have some guy who's piloting a spaceship. Here's my picture of a spaceship. A guy here sitting. And with a steering wheel. And so one design for spaceships is that there's some wind, it could be photons or some particles, and you have a sail. So here's a sail. Okay. Not the best drawing of a sail. And you can do two things to the sail. You can rotate it different orientations. So it has some normal vector, and you can also change the size of the sail. And in doing so, you couple the spaceship to this wind fluid. So the point of view here is that what's kind of happening? Well, what you could do is you could just have this spaceship, the captain, and then all the atoms in his brain, all represented in the initial state of the universe, and then you could evolve it all deterministically forward. And in so much as general relativity is a complete theory of physics, which of course it isn't, but if it were, then you would deterministically be able to solve for this situation. On the other hand, that's very cumbersome. The atoms in his brain only become relevant to the sort of the resolution that you're working to at the point when he moves the steering wheel, whatever it is that spaceships have, and the sail moves. And at that point, the degrees of freedom that you're interested in are affected. Prior to that, you don't really need to care about what's happening. So it's much better. Even if you believe that physics is fundamentally a deterministic theory, it's much better at an effective level if you can introduce these sorts of effects only when they become relevant. So that's just a way of reconciling this sort of fundamental way of thinking where you have a deterministic evolution with this effective way of thinking, which is typical in operationalism. They're not necessarily incompatible. So I'll talk in the next lecture about how to introduce agency into this framework. It's not completely trivial, although it turns out general relativity has a lot of the structure that you need to do this anyway. So it's not too difficult. Okay. Are there any more questions before I...
talking about the gammas and psi being ontological and gammas being operational.
Yeah.
But then you also have this thing where you say that the surface gamma is smooth because we demand the field to be smooth. And that ensures that. For gamma to be operational, did we want the set of scalars to be anything we want to specify?
My philosophy there is that, to make the thing work, you want a sufficient amount of smoothness that you can sort of do the kinds of things I'm trying to do, like the matching conditions and so on. Any time in physics you have discontinuities, if you use a finer level of description, then you don't really have discontinuities. For example, in quantum theory, you have scintillations on a screen which seem discontinuous, but actually, if you look at the detail, the scintillation builds up gradually, and it's actually a very continuous phenomenon. So it's always possible, it seems, in physics, to introduce a level of description where things are smoother and more continuous. For my purposes, that seems important because I want there to be. I don't want the relationship between the manifold description and the operational description to be too. Unrelated, or too disjointed, too discontinuous.
Yeah, but I guess what I was worried about is that as operational as we can be because of this constraint.
So it's possible that you could drop it and still do everything I'm trying to do. However, take one example: the matching conditions. I gave the direction condition is saying that as you go across, so the two manifolds join. I've lost the picture. And I'd be impressed if you're right. Well, at least the words are here. I think I raised it. But as you go across, we have this direction matching. That says that it's sort of smooth, or the scalars that you put as your coordinates in the typing surface have to their derivatives have to match. Now that seems like a good condition to impose to make sure that you have some sort of appropriate matching. If you dropped that there was a sort of smoothness connection between the gamma surface and the fields, or the underlying solution, then you wouldn't be able to do that. So maybe that's fine, but at least as a first step, it seems good to get more control, and then perhaps step back from that.
Also, as I said, like if you have some nice, reasonable discontinuities, then you can always approximate it by continuous gammas as close as push. Well, we introducing some bound function and stuff like that.
Yeah, these bulk functions, and then it'll be fine. So that's certainly my philosophy in the first place. But it's hard to first of all get something down, get a structure on paper, and then step away from it afterwards. Any more questions? Okay, oh, go on.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this capital lambda object, and that lets me do. Think about this statement for all capital A.
Yeah.
Did we have a condition on capital A being somehow reasonable, so it's not like a fractal or something? Does it need to be a sensible thing?
Yeah, I'm taking it to be appropriately reasonable, and
yes.
I guess I haven't sat down and really written down what those reasonable conditions are.
But I was having enough trouble with this object already.
Yeah.
It would be real value.
Yeah.
A would be anything so.
Yeah. I mean, let's assume it's specified by, you know, some finite set of smooth inequalities.
Okay.
Example. So if it was a rectangle or a cuboid, then you'd have six inequalities that specify it, but it could be, you know, some more general set of smooth inequalities. And incidentally, that sort of condition, in addition to the assumption that there's a smooth relationship between the fields and S, everything smooth, then means that the manifold regions M, A, and so on also are appropriate objects. They're not kind of crazy fractal things.
Right.
But I haven't been very careful in the paper or in these lectures to be right down those conditions. Okay, great. Thanks.